Normoudou, welcome to Health Chat. Get this, an estimated 5 million deaths per year in low and middle income countries are the result of poor quality care. And an additional 3.6 million deaths result from insufficient access to care. That's according to a new report from the Lancet Global Health Commission, the first to quantify the burden of poor quality health systems worldwide. On the program today, we will discuss health system. And I had a chance to speak with Dr. Margaret Crook. She's Associate Professor of Global Health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School and a commissioner from this report. This is what she had to say. Dr. Margaret Crook, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You were part of a study, High Quality Health Systems in the Sustainable Development Goals Era, Time for Revolution. That's the name of the study. Can you give us a sense of the study?
Absolutely. Really excited to talk to you about this topic today because we think it's a very timely moment in global health to take a look at health systems with a fresh eye. The commission that I've had the privilege of chairing is actually a commission that's far outside of Harvard. It involves 30 commissioners from 18 countries around the world. And over the past 2 years, we together have been investigating the meaning of quality, the level of quality, the measurement of quality, and I think very importantly, the improvement of quality in health systems in low and middle-income countries. As I'm sure you realize, actually the majority of the world fits under that label of low and middle-income countries. It's 140 countries or so. Mm-hmm. And those are the very countries which continue to, despite significant advances, still suffer from fairly high mortality for conditions that really should be treated in the health system.
Let's get to the basic first and define what is considered a standard quality or a high quality health system. When we talk about health systems, what are the basic standards that we should expect?
Great question. I actually think that is the question that needs to be asked before we get into measurement or improvement. So the way that the commission has defined and really redefined high-quality health systems are health systems that do three things. First of all, health systems really are fundamentally for people, not for doctors or bureaucrats or managers, but they really need to be oriented toward people and their needs. And those systems do several things. They, for the obviously, the first and critically important task is to ensure that people end up healthier. So they have to produce health or maintain health. Second, high-quality health systems have to be trusted and valued by people. And third, we think that high-quality health systems also need to be able to adapt. I think all too often we see systems that are quite static and stay stuck in previous structures, when in fact people's needs, people's diseases, and people's understanding and preferences have changed.
Now that we've determined that, let's look at the state of health systems worldwide. You talk about low and middle income countries. What were some of the basic findings?
I think the top line finding for the commission was that every year, 8.6 million deaths happen that shouldn't have happened if countries had good quality health care. That's a lot more than all of the under five mortality. It's a lot more than diabetes mortality, even than HIV mortality. It's people who are not able to either get to the system or experience poor care when they get into the system. And so specifically, out of those 8.6 million people who are needlessly dying every year, 5 million are people who are already using health care. They are experiencing poor quality. The other 3.6 million are people who can't get to health care in many of the lowest income countries in particular. So I think a big takeaway for us from that analysis is that quality is not a problem for tomorrow. It's a problem for today. It's a problem that is being faced by people who are seeking care and not getting better.
So then it seems to be clear that quality of the health system is related to the economic status of the country. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. We know that healthy people are people who can work. We know that people who are in positive mental health, who are in good physical health, are people who can contribute to their economy. There are children who can learn. So absolutely, a commission analysis estimated that just the deaths alone that I mentioned, never mind all the people who are suffering from illness that hasn't been cured, are responsible for about $6 trillion in economic losses in 1 year. But these are large productivity losses for countries that really can't afford to have them.
So then how do we even start addressing the problem when it seems to be an economic problem to address? How do we even start tackling this issue?
That's a great question. Of course, health and productivity are interrelated, and even health itself is a product of many forces, of which healthcare is just one, right? Having a good job and employment and education and housing are critical determinants of health, too. So I think one key point is definitely we do see that lowest income countries are suffering from a double burden, where there are poor economic conditions already, and then when people do get sick, they also tend to get worse care. And that's because health systems have been under-resourced and have been struggling. So it is really a vicious spiral in some cases. And we see that. We see that people seeking health care may not get better. Furthermore, they may end up spending a lot of money, what is called catastrophic spending, to pay for that health care. So in terms of getting started, we see one huge opportunity that I think many global partners in many countries have endorsed, and that is universal health coverage. So this is a policy that's being championed by the World Health Organization and the World Bank and again, many countries. And the idea is to offer insurance to the population for a set of defined services so that people feel that security and can get that care and can get better from common conditions. Now, the rub here is that all of the discussion in universal health coverage to date has really been focused very much on alleviating people's economic burden from seeking health care and covering people. What we are adding in the commission is that universal health coverage or any insurance scheme that doesn't have at its heart the quality of services is a scheme that's not going to work. It's not going to work for health because people are not going to get better even if they go to clinic, but it's also going to leave people disillusioned. You know, earlier I mentioned that trust is one of our key definitions of a high-quality health system. It's a key element. Mm-hmm. And if people see that insured services are really very low quality, they're not only going to avoid those services, they may not trust the government to provide for them in future. So we do think that both trust and health are on the line if some of these insurance expansions aren't really accompanied by a serious look at quality.
So then when we're looking at the numbers, an estimated 5 million deaths per year in low and middle income countries are the result of poor quality, an additional 3.6 million deaths resulting from insufficient access to care, as you mentioned, the total being 8.6 million people. What type of conditions are these people most often faced with?
So that was another very interesting finding for us. You know, I think we think many times that low-income countries are countries that have their main issues, their main problems are in infectious disease or maternal and child health conditions. So we were surprised to see that actually almost 2.5 million of those deaths, or deaths of the 8.6 million, are deaths from cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. So lots and lots of avertible mortality, deaths that could be averted, are being missed because we are not treating people's high blood pressure, we are not treating their diabetes, and we're not, and those are basic functions of primary care that should be available in countries that have quite low cost, and yet we're missing those opportunities. We also do see, though, that the conditions like infectious disease and maternal and child health, which we've been talking about for 20 years or longer in global health, there we have more and more people using health care. We've been encouraging them to do that. But we still see huge amounts of mortality. Many, many newborn deaths, for example, are due to poor quality care. Mm-hmm. At least half of all the global maternal deaths, women dying in labor, are due to poor quality care. So I think the big takeaway is that poor quality is a problem across many conditions, actually.
So when we talk about health care for people in rural areas, which very often is difficult to access, what do you see as an approach that could help?
Yeah, I think you're really putting your finger on a really tough issue. In the commission, we identified some things which could readily be started, could be done. But I agree with you that some of the rural and remote communities are going to have the toughest time. But maybe let me set one thing clear, which is that we found this part of the commission analysis that actually in most countries, even in the lowest income countries, the health system has spread throughout the country quite extensively. So we were surprised when we did some mapping, for example, to see how close are people to, you know, a health clinic or a hospital, But in most countries, 90% or more of the population is actually within a two-hour walk or two-hour distance from a health facility. Still very far for some people, of course, but it isn't maybe the situation that we're all imagining, which is that healthcare is out of reach to vast masses. It's just not the case. So that's the first point to make. Having said that, of course, there will be people who are more remote and living in quite difficult-to-reach areas. I think there, we, no matter whether it's for those people or people even closer to healthcare, I think we do need to embrace a national quality guarantee. And what I mean by that is that the clinic that we will put, and sometimes this is going to require additional resources if people are truly far and the government needs to serve them. Yes, put a clinic in an area that can be reached, within reach of those populations. Let's maybe limit the services that it can provide to those services that it can provide very well so that people can really count on getting good care. Now, for the remaining services that the clinic cannot guarantee, let's think and work across from the health sector with the transportation sector, communication, to help people get to the right level of care. Uh-huh. I do think that the very worst scenario is a scenario in which we pretend to give good quality in a remote clinic.
Yeah.
But people are actually pretty wise to this, and they will not use that clinic, and they may, in fact, stay home or try to seek town themselves if we don't do it. So I think let's be honest, but let's invest in quality clinics as close as we can to people. And for the remaining services, let's help people get to them instead of trying to put 1,000 clinics nearby.
Now, did you observe in your research that some of the needs and the challenges varied from one region to another, one country to another? Do you find that the quality of care, even though it's poor, in some African countries are different than the quality of care in terms of the needs?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did do that, and we looked carefully at different groups of countries by income, by region, as you said, to see if there are patterns. I think one thing we can say with some assurance is that, typically speaking, the greater the income, the better the quality. Still, the quality was not good enough, even in some of the upper middle income countries. And I should say, quality is a universal problem. We have our own quality challenges right here in the U.S. So it's not like we can say, we have reached the desired end here in this country when there are still many challenges to be faced. But we do see improvement. We do see that countries that have invested more in their health systems do a better job, and that starts with training providers, for example. The providers they're more very well-trained providers. What we do see in middle-income countries, though, is a lot of variability in care, mm-hmm. where you can see rural regions, as you mentioned earlier, doing much worse than some urban regions, and you see those disparities in quality very clearly. We also found, whereas in low-income countries, I think, there are challenges throughout the system, sometimes in middle-income countries, they're much more focal. I think the other thing to say here is that one major observation of the commission is that poor people within all countries tend to get worse quality than the wealthier people. And sometimes those differences are very large.
Let's talk about the role of healthcare workers in the whole system of care. What were your findings?
So there's no healthcare without health workers. They are absolutely fundamental to, what we're calling for in this report, which is a revolution. We have to work very closely with health workers, but also think critically about how to deploy those really scarce and very precious resources, which are, people, doctors, nurses, managers, cleaners, the full set of workforce that is needed to care for the population. I think the major observation that we made is that many healthcare workers may have a lot of book knowledge, but they're really having trouble applying that to patients. Some of our data, in fact, a lot of it, came from observing patient and doctor, patient nurse interactions, visits. Mm-hmm. And those are data that were collected in nationally representative surveys, large surveys. We reanalyzed those data. And we found that there are very large gaps in proper assessment of patients, for example, in the thoroughness of the physical exam. For example, and those gaps sometimes were even larger among doctors than among nurses. So it's not always a given the doctors will do everything better. So what that means to us when we see something of that size, a deficit of that magnitude, it makes us think that actually this can't be fixed with 1 or 2 week training courses once people are in practice. This is going to require a revision of the training models in medical and nursing education, midwifery education, health management education, and education that emphasizes competency, it emphasizes caring, it emphasizes problem solving. You know, I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. Very many doctors, in particularly and nurses, particularly in low-income countries where they've had really cash-starved health systems, you know, we'll see a fever and we'll assume it's malaria because that was the most common disease, you know, in the past several decades or even for longer than that. But today, more and more malaria is prevented and much more is treated even by patients themselves. And so doctors and nurses have to take a very different, much more critical approach to what is this fever and how can we really properly diagnose it.
I'm from a country in West Africa, and I hear these stories from friends and family members. They go to the hospital, they have a fever. They cannot figure out what you have. Oh, take a malaria treatment. That's like, okay.
Yeah, and we can't do that. We cannot do that. That is not a good health system, right? That is medicine by default. And,
yes.
You know, by the way, giving that malaria treatment over and over to people who don't need it, of course, breeds resistance. And the same can be said for antibiotics, which, of course, here in the U.S. and in other countries, is struggling to get that under control. But that is not problem-based thinking, right? That is not good quality care. So that's a great example.
Dr. Crook, what is the goal of this study? What do you hope to accomplish, and how do we move forward?
So this is an effort that, you know, I led together with Dr. Mohamed Pate, who is the former state minister of health in Nigeria. And we explicitly paired an academic with a former policymaker who is now a global health champion and advocate. And our whole commission was organized in that way, with academics working alongside policymakers, so that we could both produce work that I hope is rigorous and tough and science-based. But at the same time, we are extremely interested in impact. And so we had policymakers talk to us about the political aspects of this agenda. So when you ask what do we hope to accomplish, I really do think it's in the title of the report, which is a revolution is needed, a whole new way of thinking. I think actually that quality is at the heart of global health equity and our shared desire to achieve the sustainable development goals, to work together with the global community. I think that we've been letting this issue linger because it's been difficult and it's been uncomfortable and it's been hard to measure. But we really hope to lift the lid on this difficult issue by defining it, hopefully more simply, by describing its state and the sort of dire need for improvement, and then involving these policymakers who are taking some of the commission ideas and debating and discussing them in their countries to say, what can we do?
So then, what do you see as the way forward?
So I think it will be on multiple fronts. This is a very big agenda, and we have a lot of work to do. I think the one front in this revolution is for countries to take the lead and say, you know, as we expand insurance, as we think about our health system investments, we will prioritize quality over quantity. We will prioritize quality over political points because, by the way, clinics are very attractive to politicians. But we want not more clinics, but more quality clinics. So we have a number of conversations, and there's a number of, I should also say that there were 9 countries that conducted their own independent commissions along with our global commission to examine this issue in their country. And for example, South Africa will be having a health summit that we hope will be focused on the issues of quality. Nepal is moving forward on this issue, India and other countries. So that's one next step, is to have countries embrace this report, hopefully, and the you know, research in it, and really say we can make progress, because we do think there are political benefits to be gained from moving forward, as well as health and economic benefits that we discussed earlier. That's one big one. I think the other one for me as an academic, who I want to support that first agenda, but it's not for me to do, where I think we can add value as academics and policy and community is in creating the evidence and the measurement that's going to make this easier for people to track, easier for people to see if the investment paid off. It's going to be to sort of explain what the data are telling us and what are the implications. I think we hope to be truth tellers in this universe where I think it's very easy to call, for example, a clinic that has a decent supply of antimalarials and a few stethoscopes. You know, we've been calling those good quality clinics. We don't agree with that. We think good quality is manifested in the care visit, in the competence and in the respect that the patient gets and in whether that patient got better. So we're going to be pushing the agenda on measurement mm-hmm. as well as improvement and creating the evidence for improvement that countries can learn from.
Dr. Margaret Crook, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that was Dr. Margaret Crook, Associate Professor of Global Health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. It is now time to take a short break. When we come back, we will look at health systems in some countries.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Welcome back to Health Chat. If you're just joining us, today we are looking at health systems. In a report released recently, the World Health Organization says Africans are living longer and healthier lives. But there are still many challenges. VOA's Sophia Christensen reports.
Meeting in Dakar this week with officials from 47 African countries. The WHO said Africans are living longer lives in good health. Healthy life expectancy on the continent rose from 44.4 years at the turn of the century to 53.8 years in 2015. Overall life expectancy climbed from 50.8 years to 61.2. Matidiso Moeti is the WHO's regional director for Africa.
What's produced this result is a huge increase in access to treatment for HIV/AIDS and in the better in prevention and better management of malaria.
But the WHO says the type of disease that most commonly affects Africans is also changing. While the number of deaths from diarrheal disease, respiratory infections, and HIV is falling, chronic conditions, such as cancer and heart disease, are claiming more lives. Death rates from non-communicable diseases have remained steady since 2000, while the other top 10 causes of mortality in Africa have fallen by 40%. The WHO says health services in Africa have been slow to adapt to the new health challenges. Humphrey Karamagi is a Sustainable Development Goal Coordinator for the WHO. He says the health needs of African youth are too often overlooked.
The kind of health challenges that adolescents face are quite different from what we have been used to responding to. Drug use, adolescent obesity, and so on.
Many African health officials and experts point to a lack of funding. But Stanley Okolo, head of the West African Health Organization, says that is overly simplistic.
There is health, which is an issue in terms of investment, health funding, but there is also an issue in terms of health systems and how you can deliver better value for the money you have. And both have to be tackled simultaneously.
African nations spend an average 40% of their health budgets on medical products, while barely a fifth goes to medical staff and infrastructure. Health officials from Kenya, Nigeria, and Cabo Verde say they are responding to the rise in non-communicable diseases by focusing on prevention and promoting healthy lifestyles. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
Next, VOA's Rael Ombuor takes a look at health system in Kenya.
The Kenyan government says the deal to import Cuban doctors would help counter gaps in Kenya's medical facilities. Kenya Cabinet Secretary for Health Cecily Kariuki explains.
The target is to bring 100 specialized doctors from Cuba. One, because of the HR resource gap that we have. We are careful not to cloud the place with general doctors. And therefore, the aim of my ministry is to bring forward critical care physicians at that level, family physicians, physicists, oncologists, and surgeons dealing with plastic reconstructive surgery, dealing with orthopedic surgery, and dealing with neurosurgery.
Each Kenyan county is expected to get at least two of the specialist doctors. But Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union Chairman Samuel Oroko says the move will not address the systemic dysfunction in Kenya's health system.
There are no drugs, theaters are not functioning, laboratories are not functioning. So even if they come and the system is not functioning, they're coming just to be idle. And they may not get equipment to use to train our own. So we need to look at all angles of our health system. Don't just bring in because of bringing in. Also ensure the system is functional. As they come, they can also operate.
The agreement will also see Kenya work with Cuba on collaborative research projects, training for healthcare workers, and collaborations in fields such as genetic engineering and biotech work. Former Kenyan Minister of Medical Services, Professor Anyang Nyong'o, visited Cuba and says Kenya will benefit from the agreement.
But as a health minister, I came here and we were trying to work things together. And I actually proposed some things that we need to do. For example, malaria vector control, collaborating with the Teaching Engineering Biotechnology Center and all that. But unfortunately, we didn't get far. What gives me satisfaction this time is that the president is determined that we implement these long-standing proposals of collaboration between us and Cuba.
Oroko says the medical union is not against any collaboration or partnership with other governments.
Our appeal and our advice is, as we consider to bring in expertise from other countries, we need to exhaust what we have locally, and if we lack capacity locally, then we should focus on training our own so that they can be used to manage our patients in Kenya.
The union says more than 1,200 Kenyan doctors have been unemployed since May 2017.
Equally, we do have a number of doctors who have qualified, both general practitioners and specialists, who are not being employed and they are Kenyan.
Kariuki says there are plans to absorb the graduate doctors into the healthcare system, but she says Kenya will still not be able to meet the recommended doctor-to-patient ratio. Oroko says about 4,300 doctors work in the public sector for Kenya's 38.6 million people.
There is the required number of doctors we are supposed to have as a facility, and that is public knowledge. Population requires to have one doctor per 1,000 patients in any given population. Currently in Kenya, we only have one doctor per 24,000 patients. Where are they going to get the money to pay the ones coming from Cuba?
The union blocked attempts by the government to bring in doctors from Tanzania at the height of its 3-month strike last year. The agreement ending the strike called for pay increases and medical risk allowances. Rael Ombuor for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. For more on today's topic, check us out online at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat. Log on to our website at voanews.com/health. And I'm your host, Linor Mudu in Washington, with producer Bonsa Tufa. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day. We'll be right back.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. A federal judge today told former U.S. National